Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
Well, welcome to Reconstruction, the weekly podcast from the Construction Index. It's Wednesday, the 6th of January, and our first episode of 2021. New year, new start, same old virus. I'm David Taylor, editor of the Construction Index magazine, and with me, via the internet of course, and not in person, is my colleague Phil Bishop, editor of our daily online news service at www.theconstructionindex.co.uk. Happy New Year, Phil!
Well, new year.
Yeah, you can't argue with that bit. Are you well? Did you have a good break?
Yes, I did have a good break. I can't complain. Everyone, all my nearest and dearest are still healthy.
Good.
And trying to stave off the doom and gloom. It gets worse whenever I pick up a newspaper or watch the television news. So I'm trying to confine my reading to the, you know, the sports pages and my TV viewing to the trashy entertainment programmes and quiz shows and just ignore the world as far as possible.
I have to say, I sat down and I watched the Channel 4 news yesterday evening, and it went on and on and on the same, obviously the same topic. Sitting next to me on the settee was my oldest daughter, who after about, I don't know, seemed like 45 minutes of unremitting COVID-19, said, "Shall we watch something else, Dad?" So we switched to Netflix instead.
Much better.
So, yeah, it's tiring and it's a bit depressing if you dwell on it, but it's what it is, as they say. So we're all locked down again. We're not going to dwell on that today, though, I think, Phil. There will be plenty to say about
No, let's try and
COVID-19.
Keep things... I don't know if we're going to be cheery today, but let's try and change the subject as far as we can.
Yes, let's change it completely. And what tell me what's caught your eye in the news this past week or so.
Well, apart from COVID, I mean the other big story of the Christmas and New Year period, which is another tedious, boring subject, but we need to talk about it briefly. But hang on in here, folks. We won't do it for very long, but we just need to acknowledge the fact that a Brexit deal has been done, which is broadly being accepted as good news. I haven't read the details. I don't know if anyone's actually read the details.
It's about 2,000 words long, isn't it?
Pages.
Or 2,000 pages. 2,000 pages long, yeah. 2,000 words actually is quite digestible. But
I mean, the headline is which makes it good news, is that there are no tariffs. We may not have freedom of movement of people, but the goods can come between mainland Europe and this little island off the north coast of Europe freely or relatively freely, as much as the ports will allow. Although I can't help thinking that it won't be long before we have French fishermen or French farmers blockading Calais, and there'll be hold-ups become a routine feature of blocking trade in the months and years ahead. So we'll see how it all pans out. But essentially, the initial fears of materials not reaching building sites appears to have been put to one side, at least in the way, the scale that of the threat that there was or there had been in the event of a no-deal Brexit.
So that was really the biggest concern, wasn't it, from the construction industry's point of view, was the availability of building materials and stuff like that that could have thrown a huge spanner in the works. Probably quite an achievement, actually, to have struck a deal that seems to address that problem. I did notice, though, I think it was somebody from the RIBA, the Royal Institute of British Architects, pointed out that the deal sort of, obviously it covers goods and materials, but not services. I'm not absolutely sure that that's correct, but there seems to be some concern that we haven't actually come to any agreement on the mutual recognition of professional qualifications, and of course that could potentially be a problem, I suppose, if you're going to go and work overseas, or if people from Europe are going to come over here and work.
Well, there are an awful lot of details like that that have yet to be, that will mutate and will move. it's really just day one of independent United Kingdom, or Great Britain, I should say. Northern Ireland is being treated rather differently. So much for the union. And yeah, you mentioned professional regulations. I'm interested in how the whole product, and particularly machinery marking, is going to play out in the coming years.
Yeah.
Do you remember for many years there's a bit, used to be a on-running story about the legitimacy of grey imports, and if people imported a used digger or crane from Japan, for example, it wasn't CE marked, and people went, "Oh, it's not CE marked," and then the person who imported it could self-certify it as long as they had the what's it called, the folder, the documentation that they could put together.
Right.
Call them, define them in law as the manufacturer, even though they're not the manufacturer, they're just the importer who's then CE marked it and said, it's fine, believe us. Now, I haven't heard any mention of what grey import might mean now that we're not part of the EU. And we have our own UK, I can't remember what it's called, UK marking, UK mark or something, another a UK version of a type mark for products and machines. Yeah. And I think for products it's more straightforward, but for machinery, I think there are things yet to happen that we haven't heard talk about, I'm guessing.
Well, I imagine that the Construction Equipment Association would have a view on that. They might like to illuminate that topic if they're listening, and let us know what the situation is. It would certainly be worth finding out where we stand with that. I mean, I haven't even considered the question of grey imports. In fact, it isn't a phrase I've heard for a long time, but I suppose it is a topic which would need to be addressed.
Now it's all about emissions, as long as they comply with the emissions requirements. But at the moment, the UK is utterly and totally aligned to Brussels emission regulation. Yes. It goes a bit further in London with the low emission zone, ultra low emission zone, and the London construction sites. Certain other cities have got tighter rules, but broadly as a nation, it's all stage four, stage five. This is what we need to follow. And at some point, one would assume, the government will say either we like Brussels regulations on machinery, we'll stick by that, it makes it easy and simple, or they're going to go, we can't listen to Brussels, we've got no input into their lawmaking process, we're going to have our own machinery emissions standards and go its own way. But I think it'll always be done in reference to what ISO and Brussels do.
But I get, unless I'm mistaken, I think that actually the UK has taken a leading role in the development of these EU standards on construction equipment. So, you know, we're here in the UK, we're the author of a lot of the standards which now apply across the community.
But the UK,
so presumably we'd be in favour of retaining that.
But the UK has had a major role in most of the things which have come out of Brussels. The idea that all this Brussels legislation over the past, you know, 10, 20 years is just some foreign French German plot and construct is palpable nonsense.
You're quite right.
You know, British diplomats or civil servants have been deeply in there, and as have British politicians, deeply involved in what's come out of Brussels over the years. So it's, there's a lot of stuff that we've been perfectly happy to support, and, you know, do we continue to support it? Hey, let's see.
I think we've discussed this before, but there are options, aren't there, of simply sort of translating EU standards into British standards. I think there's a...
Well, that's day one, isn't it? Day one is we start from that position.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
And then we're now free to move in, you know, other directions.
Okay.
Bored of Brexit, everyone? Should we move on?
I am. Oh dear.
Well, I've got a much more interesting story for you, which is, I think it's more interesting. It's something that I posted up on Construction Index website this morning. I was sent something by an organisation I'd never heard of before, a campaign group called the HRE Group, which they don't spell it out, but I suspect it stands for Heritage Railway Estate or Historic Rail Engineers or something to do with that. Because these people are enthusiasts for rail heritage. And they have written to the Transport Minister to complain about Highways England being a bit too gung-ho for their liking about knocking down and filling in old, abandoned, disused railway bridges, viaducts and tunnels.
Mm-hmm.
You might think, Highways England? Are you sure this is a railway thing?
Yes, that was my first thought. What are they doing messing around with rail structures?
This is all news to me, but Highways England took over responsibility for the Department of Transport's historical railways estate in 2013. The historical railways estate is a collection of around 3,200 bridges, tunnels and viaducts. Some of them carry railways over waterways or roads or whatever, and some are the railways go under them, or what used to be a railway goes under them. A lot of these, they're now no longer part of the railway. So Network Rail have got no interest. Network Rail aren't going to look after them. And so Department of Transport said, Highways England, you've got plenty of civil engineers and bridge engineers and you don't understand structures. Can you look after them, sort them out? And so initially...
It really does appear that Highways England took on this role very reluctantly. I get the impression that they really can't be asked to look after these structures. They were told, go on, mend these bridges, and they're like, what, us?
Well, it's clearly not part of their remit. I guess there are some of them that maybe, I don't know, but if they carry roads over X railway lines, they can't be abandoned, can they? They can't be defunct. They must. So, I guess it's just the only organisation left in government that had, in the Department of Transport, that had some civil engineers and structural engineers on board. Yeah. But anyway, they had a budget, according to the information sent to me by this campaigning group, HRE group, Highways England had £10 million a year to monitor and, where need, patch up these old abandoned structures. And then in 2016, Highways England published a strategic report saying that a lot of these bridges are falling down, they serve no purpose, they're in the way, we need to either get rid of them or fill them in. Fill in the tunnels. There's no use to them. We've got to reduce our liability. At which point, various particular organisations, some of them are little local hobby railway groups, what you call them.
Yeah, rail enthusiasts.
Yes, but the people who run these steam trains for fun or for tourism or whatever.
And not just rail enthusiasts though, Phil, but also because a lot of these disused rail routes are now cycle routes. They're green lanes. The wider community really, rather than just the rail enthusiasts.
Well, that's the other side of it. There are two interest groups, if you like, who are concerned about these old abandoned rail routes. The one which is referenced here is the Somerset and Dorset Railway Heritage Trust. At Chilcompton in Somerset, they were looking to extend their line that they have running down there, and Highways England wanted to infill a bridge. The Railway Heritage Trust had a bit of a battle with Highways England about, I don't know whether it was filled in the end or whether they won it, but the point is that they weren't consulted. It was just Highways England, we're just going to go ahead and do this. And as you say, the other side of the coin is all the cycling, countryside access, walking, people who want more footpaths and footways. And a lot of these abandoned railway lines are, are wonderful country walks that you can use. And if you're walking along and suddenly where you used to walk under a disused railway bridge and suddenly it's all bricked up and you can't get through the railway bridge, your walk comes to a dead end, that's a bit of a shame. And so I see both sides to this one, because, the Highways England's got this liability. It's spending money for no particular purpose, as it sees it. But what's making it controversial, particularly, is that it's using permitted development rights to go ahead and do the work.
And so it's doing it on the sly.
That's how it's being interpreted.
That's how
there are no notices going up or saying, listen up, everyone. This is about to happen. Do you object? Do you want to talk to us about it? Have you got any other better ideas? It's just happening.
They're just doing it, yeah.
And it's perfectly legal. You know, shouldn't say it's sly, but anyway, it all seems to me that the mistake in the first place was giving this job to Highways England. It should have been given to local authorities. I mean, local authorities seem to me the people who should be looking after local heritage and local conservation, or at least sponsoring it. But so much of this stuff is left in the hand of volunteer groups and amenities associations and heritage trusts and so on, looking after the countryside and footpaths. And it's not, government is not particularly interested in that sort of thing, but it should at least facilitate other people, these other groups and local authorities, to do that.
Yeah. I think there are two ironies that stuck out, really caught my attention here. The first one is that here's Highways England saying that they want to significantly reduce the level of liability and risk to Highways England and the Department of Transport. Basically, it's too time-consuming and expensive to maintain all these structures. And in order to go around demolishing them, they've had their budget quadrupled. So we're not actually saving money, certainly not in the short term. The other irony is, as is pointed out by this campaign group, the HRE group, is that this is a classic example of unjoined up government, because here's the government on one hand saying it wants to get people out and enjoying
walking
the countryside
and
walking, cycling, doing all the rest of it. And these routes are really very extensive and very important locally for precisely that purpose. I don't know about the area where you live, Phil, in central Kent, but here in North Devon, we've got something called the Tarka Trail, which is named after the Henry Williamson book, Tarka the Otter. He is a local author. The Tarka Trail, which is basically some disused railway lines which were taken out of action by Dr. Beeching back in the 1960s. And of course, they're nice, flat, level tracks. And people cycle up and down those, not just for recreation, but actually to get to and from work. I can't remember how many miles the Tarka Trail actually extends to, but it's very extensive all over North Devon. And there's also the Barnstaple to Linton Railway, which is a light railway.
Back to the Tarka Trail. Who looks after that? Is that a local authority thing?
Or
is
it
a charitable
good
trust?
Good question. And I'm not sure. I suspect it's the local authority.
I don't know. I bet it's a charitable trust.
Yeah, it could be. I honestly don't know. You've caught me out there. The Linton and Barnstaple Railway is a disused railway between the towns of Barnstaple and Linton, obviously. Light railway, which there is a short section of track. Here again, it's an enthusiast group, a steam enthusiast group, have reinstated a length of track up on Exmoor, which is a big tourist attraction. Every year people flock to that. There's also a wonderful viaduct at a place called Chelfham Mill, just outside Barnstaple, which was one of the first structures ever built by Edmund Nuttall. Wonderful building, and I don't know, presumably that is one of the Highways England structures that it needs to look after. I don't know whether or not that's the organisation that does the light railway, whether they contribute or not. But, you know, these are important and very well-known local routes, and there are places like this all over the country, your routes and structures all over the country, which play an important role in the community and in tourism, local businesses, that sort of thing. And I think that there is here, I mean, I've only seen this press release, the same as you, Phil. And I've read your story, so I haven't looked into it in any detail. But I think that this campaign group has a strong case, because these are important assets. And if you look at some of these structures, they're beautiful, you know, sort of 150-year-old part of the engineering heritage of the country. I don't know if any of them listed, presumably some of them might be, but I think they should be preserved wherever possible. And I think this is a false economy, quite frankly.
I'm more pragmatic about preserving or knocking down things if they have no particular use or value. But I am exercised by the idea that potential walkways and cycle paths which we should be exploiting and developing, will not now be able to be developed and exploited because of a tunnel being filled in, for example. Could ask the question, if it hasn't been filled in for the, you know, since Beeching closed it 50-odd years ago, well, shouldn't really complain. We should have done something about it earlier. And in Highways England's defence, I mean, Highways England, I did ask them, this seems interesting, what's all this about then? And they sort of admitted that they are planning to infill 115 bridges and remove 15 structures over the next 5 years. Most of them are over 100 years old and not designed to carry the weight of modern traffic. Mm. And they say they've contacted all the local authorities affected to tell them what they're going to do and see if they've got any use for the structures. And seven of the structures are going to be transferred to the local authorities concerned for use in cycle routes. So there is some movement. Some local authorities are going, hang on a minute, not so quick. You know, we can do something here. We can step in. Yeah. But it does seem that there are going to be a lot more little local controversies to come in every one of these bridges and structures that are being tampered with.
I mean, I wouldn't go so far as to say that there is absolutely no justification for infilling bridges or tunnels in certain cases. I'm sure there are. This campaign group does cite a couple of examples where the consulting engineer concerned said that work had to be done because of the poor state of the structure, when in actual fact recent surveys had revealed that they were in good condition. So, I mean, that's just one example. I'm sure that there are examples where this is entirely justified, and I don't disagree with that in that case. I think it's just the way that it's being done without any consultation, or has so far been done without any consultation, which is, you know, it just gets all the alarm bells ringing, really.
Yes, I hope that we've helped, HRE Group deserve the credit for it, but I hope we've helped them shine a bit of light on this underreported issue.
Well, it's interesting. It is an interesting topic. I will look at old disused railway bridges with renewed interest from now on.
Well, if you want to know where they are, all these bridges associated with the HRE Group, it seems to be a chap called Graham Bickerdike, who writes about railways. He writes for Rail Engineer magazine from time to time, I believe. He's got a website called ForgottenRelics.co.uk, and it lists all the old railway structures, 19th century railway pioneers put up, which are either no longer used or at risk, disused ones and listed ones and so on. And so that's quite an interesting website to look at, ForgottenRelics.co.uk.
Something to browse through during lockdown.
On the subject, having said I had some sympathy for Highways England, I'm very suspicious when they say we're doing it for safety, which is part of what they're doing. Mm. They're not saying they're doing it to save money. They say we're doing this for safety. Yeah. Because Highways England have completely, in my eyes, lost credibility for saying that they put safety first. They may be very good at building roads and delivering projects and, you know, all credit to the A14 job coming in on time, etc. But the idea that they put safety first has been proved to be bunking by the whole smart motorways fiasco.
Yes.
If they really put safety first, they wouldn't have got rid of hard shoulders and moved refuge areas further apart than they were supposed to be, to save money, to put in speed cameras, to put in technology to gather road tolls in the future, at some unspecified time in the future. No, they've lost that argument already, I'm afraid. Anyway, that's
yes, I agree.
Diversion, my hobby horse of smart motorways.
So that's historic bridges and tunnels, I think, comprehensively discussed. Anything else in the news this week? I know there is, actually, Phil, because there was a very interesting article which you posted, I think, on Monday. Was it Monday?
Tuesday this week. Barclay Group Holdings, the house builder.
Yeah.
It's a fairly usual mundane announcement that these listed companies put out occasionally, saying that, you know, a couple of their non-executive board directors are retiring. They've done their stint on the board and they've found some other worthy to come on the board. And normally these non-executive directors are some recently retired other boardroom person. I mean, for example, John Armit, a familiar name to, I hope, many of our listeners, has been on the board as a non-executive director, has been on the board of Barclays for about a decade now, I think. And one of the new people coming on board is on the Barclays board is a predictably managing partner of a private equity firm. Another one's a former PwC partner, sort of people that...
So far, so predictable, exactly. Really.
What caught my eye, though, is that Barclay Group, this hugely successful, hugely profitable, buccaneering house builder, has appointed the Archdeacon of Hackney to their board of directors as a non-executive, the Venerable Elizabeth Attacunley. And that I found quite remarkable. I mean, I used to occasionally seeing vicars and bishops on the boards of charities and housing associations and do-good organisations. And I'm sure Barclay Group would like to think of themselves as a do-good organisation, but their first job is to make money, to give shareholders a return. So I cannot think of another, certainly FTSE, I think Barclays FTSE 100, certainly FTSE 200, if not FTSE 150. Mm-hmm. Sorry, FTSE 250, if not FTSE 100. I cannot think of other companies that size who have got clergy on their board of directors.
No. And it does seem... No,
and I find it fascinating and interesting.
Not house builders.
It could be the start of a whole new
trend. House builders not... Yeah, well, it does... Maybe they're taking a new direction. I nearly said turning over a new leaf, but that seems to suggest that they were doing something wrong previously. But no, maybe it does signal a change in directions, a change in attitudes, perhaps... being less buccaneering and a little bit more touchy-feely. I don't know. I mean, house builders are not generally known for their spiritual credentials, are they? They're more usually come across as voraciously profit-motivated engines of capitalism. But this appointment is, I think, a clear signal that there's a change afoot. I mean, I don't think that the Archdeacon herself has much experience in business. I mean, I've had a look at her Wikipedia entry, and she has a strong track record in sort of community liaison type roles, and she advises the police on ethical and diversity issues. And I suppose a house builder has a huge impact on the community. I mean, they build the homes that people live in.
So, but it's not unusual to have, if a publicly quoted company has got a full complement of non-executive directors, of let's say half a dozen non-executive directors, it's not unusual that while maybe four or five of those are ex-boredom great and grand ex-CEOs or ex-finance directors or somewhere or other, it's not unusual for one or two of them to be slightly, if I'm allowed to use the term, left field choices, or maybe from an HR side or from to bring another perspective one way or another. I mean, for example, one of the outgoing members of the Barclay board is an old, I say old, former newspaper editor, Veronica Wadley. And she clearly, while may have had solid managerial experience, didn't have true business experience in the capitalist sense, but would have brought a definite viewpoint to the boardroom, which I'm sure would have been valuable. So I can imagine that this Archdeacon, with her experience and her perspective and her relative youth, I mean, she's only early 40s, which is quite young to be on the board of a major company like that, will bring a certain, an interesting different perspective, I imagine. Now, to what extent she'll be listened to, or to what extent she'll just be used as virtue signalling, as kind of, ooh, look what we've done, that remains to be seen. But I can't imagine that she's not a strong personality to have got where she's got. She must be a strong personality.
No, she's obviously very bright.
Exactly.
I mean, she's got some multiple degrees. I don't suppose she's just going to be there. Well, I don't suppose she's just going to be there as a sort of a trophy cleric sort of thing. Yeah, I suppose we'll have to see if this appointment actually translates into a change in policy at Barclay Homes.
Well, if any big company wants to go better than an archdeacon and wants to have a bishop on their board, I'm available for suitable remuneration.
So is that it for the week then, Phil? Are we done? Is this?
I think so.
Was there anything else you wanted to add?
Our end of the year roundup podcast went on for so long. I think people were relieved to have a shorter bite to start the year off. But as the year gets going, I'm sure we'll. What do you think we'll be talking about the most this year, apart from COVID and Brexit? It'll all be HS2, do you think?
I think HS2 will definitely loom large. There's that other sort of mega project, Hinkley Point, which I haven't really seen much news on recently. There's been quite a lot of talk about another of these European reactors being built at somewhere on the Suffolk coast, which is the next one in the pipeline, and I think that's going to get people very excited. But I don't think anything is going to happen, and anything definitive is going to happen with that project. This year, at least. So, I don't know. Certainly HS2, possibly Hinkley Point.
I think...
Do you think Crossrail might be finished?
Oh, good point. No, I don't, to be honest.
You'd forgotten about Crossrail, hadn't you? Yes, everybody has forgotten
about
Crossrail.
Well, there'll be no one allowed to... hardly anyone travelling on the tube anyway, so...
No, that's right.
I think electric battery-powered plant is something we've talked a lot about before. And
that's
going to run and run. Yeah. I think it's fabulous the way that GGR, they're the distributor for the Farizon electric telehandler, gloating about how they've got this Italian-made telehandler onto the British market quicker than JCB have got theirs turning off the production line. And they posted a photo somewhere. They found that the JCB have one of these Farizon electric telehandlers at the JCB factory, which they're obviously running the rule over. GGR sort of messaged JCB to say, can we have one of yours as well, please? if you ever get it finished.
I didn't know that. It's almost good fun stuff.
I mean, they're the pair of them are ahead of the curve.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with healthy competition. And I think you're right. I think that electric plant will definitely be, and other forms of alternative fuel will be in the news again this year.
But for this week, I think we've talked enough, David. We've got to...
Yes, I think you're right.
..knuckle down. But I'd like to, once again, thank everyone for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast of the Construction Index. Our contact details, as per usual, podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. You can read more about what we've been talking about at theconstructionindex.co.uk. But from me, Phil Bishop, and from him, David Taylor, Happy New Year. Stay safe, stay upbeat, and cheerio.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.